Hey everybody, this is DJ Q for the Golf News Met Radio Network. We now return you to Jay's Place, already in progress.
All right, thank you, DJ Q, for bringing us back from commercial. He is absolutely right. I am Jay Flemma of the Golf News Net Radio Network, and you are listening to Jay's Plays. Welcome back to the second half of the show, everybody. Big thank you to Kevin Cook, former editor-in-chief of Sports Illustrated and Golf Magazine, for joining us on the first half of the show of the first show of 2016. So always great to hear from him. You can check out all the cool things that he's doing online. And now we're going to bring back an old and dear friend, pun intended. I used to write with him for many years over at CyberGolf. Last summer we finally got together, and actually we're reporting live from Chambers Bay together. And then when CyberGolf said thank you and, you know, good night, everybody, we both found it over to Ryan Balogie and the Golf News Network. Now he writes with me once again. Please give a warm Jay's Place welcome to our European correspondent, Tony Deere. Welcome back to Jay's Place, Tony.
Thanks for having me, Jay. It's great to be back.
Oh, yeah, it's a ton of fun. Hey, when the old gang gets back together for a hoot. all we need now is to get Marino Perez-Senzo and Jeff Shelley together, you know, and we can fire up the hot dogs and, you know, break out the tequila, I guess, in Jeff's case. It'd be more like, you know, order some Thai food and, you know, sip some scotch or something.
We should go to Jeff's house and listen to his record collection. It's amazing. You ever seen it?
Oh, of course I have. I've stayed at Jeff's on a number of occasions, including last year. He does have an excellent record collection. A lot of good old stuff. Okay, I like the fact that he also likes Talking Heads like I do.
For sure, yeah. I've been listening to a lot of Talking Heads recently. I love it.
Yeah. In fact, my run this morning, there was a big, long, delicious version of Cross-Eyed and Painless that came on midway through my 7.5 mile run in 11 degree weather. So that definitely made going up that hill a lot easier. So it was a good energetic run today, man. We needed it. 7.5 miles up and down those hills. So anyway, so there's a lot of cool things that you've been working on. So fill everybody in on what's been happening with you since last summer when you made the jump from Golf News Network, from CyberGolf over to Golf News Network.
Well, you probably know a book that I wrote about 6 months ago came out, was published in, I believe it was October, in the States, and had been published about 4 weeks previously to that in Europe and Australia, I think. That's been out for, 3 months now, and I think it's getting some nice reviews. It's really encouraging and pleasing.
We're going to talk about that. Why don't you tell everybody the title of the book so that they can go check it out? What's the name of it?
The title is The Story of Golf in 50 Holes, and it's published by a small publisher, boutique publisher in Brighton, England, called Quid Publishing, but in North America, the publisher is Firefly Books, who are out of Toronto, Canada.
Excellent. Okay, and tell us about the story of golf in 50 holes.
Well, the idea was put to me by the publisher in Brighton, England, who I'd written a book for before. They were excellent. We got them really well. We have a really good relationship. They came to me with the idea about, let me think, it's getting on 2 years ago now. And, you know, I was a little reluctant at first because, you know, there have been 1,000 books written on the history of golf and how you approach it differently. And we discussed this 50 holes idea, and we thought that's never been done before. But then we had to figure out the right number of holes to do, because 100 would probably be too many, 10 would be too few, blah, blah, blah. So we needed a number of holes that would give a good idea of the history of golf, but wouldn't be overload. And then we had to discuss the geographical distribution of these holes, because this book was going to be
international,
all over the world. Yeah, absolutely. So there, you know, it had to be some Australian and Japanese holes and continental European holes. And it came together, and they eventually commissioned it in about June of last, hang on, let me get this right, June 2014, and I had about 6 weeks to write it, and then it goes, you know, it goes through a very lengthy process of binding and other publishing things, and it came out in September of last year in Britain and October in the States.
Excellent. Now, I have a copy of the book here. You were kind enough to send it to me. There's many good choices for some of the historic holes in golf. Of course, you've got two holes from St. Andrews in particular. You've got 11 and 17, two of the most famous holes in golf, and two of my favorites, the Eden Hole and the Road Hole. Explain to everybody the importance of the Eden Hole and the Road Hole.
Well, when they were built, obviously they were just built because of that's what happened with the land. There was no architect around those days who came along and put earth here and earth there and dug up holes here and there. That's just what the land looked like, and that's what the golf hole looks like. And they're just fascinating holes in the sense that everything we love about a great golf hole. One, it looks good. Two, it's strategically enjoyable. And you know, a lot of people get that concept wrong. If you can build a hole that is attractive to a range of golfers, I mean, a scratch golfer can play it off the back tee, and it's a hard par for him. You know, it's a really difficult. Now, if you can keep that mantra in mind, then I think the architect is on to a winner, because if you look at both the 11th and 17th hole especially, it looks like one of the hardest holes in the world. And you watch it on TV at the Open Championship and you think, how on earth could you possibly play that hole? But if you're mid-handicapper and you play it off one of the forward tees, you go left of the wall, you make it onto the front of the fairway, you bump a hybrid 180, 90 yards up the fairway, then you've got a lob wedge onto the green over the road bunker, and it's a lot easier than obviously hitting a 4 or 5 iron onto a green that shallow. So they're very important holes in the sense that they, first of all, they're natural, which is incredible that they should be such great holes with nothing done to them, really. But they should be so great because they appeal to every single golfer you can imagine, because they're easy to bogey, but they're a hard par. And I think that's just a great mantra of the architect should live by.
I bet there's a bunch of guys that would say that they don't think that the 17th at St. Andrews is an easy bogey.
That's very true. I think I played it the first two or three times I played it. I never made a bogey.
Well, yeah. I have a dear friend you may know, Tony Korologos, who made what the folks at St. Andrews called perhaps the greatest four ever on that hole, as he hit his tee shot out of bounds into the hotel, hit his next tee shot into the fairway, and then promptly hold out the iron shot for a par.
You're kidding. No way.
Way. Okay, great story. Yeah, Tony Korologos, he's been a frequent guest on our show on occasion, so we'll have to give him a shout-out over at Hooked on Golf. And he's a dear friend of many of the caddies over there and some of the other writers from over there. So, you know, we're a small and close-knit family. St. Andrews, of course, you know, the holy grail of golf courses then, and Augusta National. And, you chose, other than Amen Corner, you have three holes from Augusta National, three good ones, of course. You've got 10, 15, and 17. You know, everyone knows 10, everyone knows 15. Tell us a little bit about why you chose 17.
That's a good question. And going back to your previous question, one of the things that I was wanted to be clear about, that this wasn't my favorite 50 holes, or it wasn't the 50 greatest holes in golf. This was 50 holes where momentous things happened in the game's history, and that, you know, somehow are connected to the game's history. And it wasn't meant to be an all-encompassing history book that, you know, takes you from start to finish, because, you know, as I said before, there's 1,000 history books, and none of them can possibly hope to, cover the entire subject. So this was like a taster, you know, for beginning golfers, and, you know, obviously for older golfers, seasoned golfers, you know, it was supposed to, be an enjoyable read, and give them a few details that they haven't heard before or read before, but for beginners, those people who are new to golf, it was like a taster, you know, something to get you interested in the game and make you want to read more of the history. Now, the 17th is, you know, it certainly isn't one of the best holes at Augusta National. Certainly isn't one of my favorites. And it's very different to how Alistair McKenzie first planned it. You know, when he designed it, it was a run-up hole. There were no bunkers in the front of the green. And it was much shorter, obviously, in those days, but it was a drive, and then, you know, you approached the green with a run-up shot, and then Perry Maxwell came in the 30s, and he put the bunkers in left and right. And apparently, I'm not sure how exactly this happened in those days, but Clifford Roberts was very unhappy about the design of the hole, because it went against Alistair McKenzie's run-up idea. But I'm not sure how I don't understand how Perry Maxwell could build those bunkers, put those bunkers in left and right, and Clifford Roberts not know about it beforehand and put a stop to it if he disliked it that much. There's a great story there. I couldn't find it, and I wonder if anyone could. But I would like to know how Perry Maxwell was allowed to build those bunkers in front of the green at 17.
Well, we're going to have to consult Chris Closer on that one. He might have an answer for us. He's the nation's leading expert right now, either he or Rand Morissette.
I think that would be a great idea. And it's something I'm intrigued by because, you know, Alistair McKenzie was obviously, he was the man of the day. He had come from designing, you know, Royal Melbourne and a couple of other courses in Australia. He had a great reputation in England. And Bobby Jones sought him out. So Alistair McKenzie was very important even then, and yet a few years later, you know, his first hole was very different. Or what is now the 10th hole, you know, was the first hole when Alistair McKenzie designed the course and when it opened. And his first hole was a short par 4 down the hill, and the huge bunker that you see in the middle of the fairway, that was to the left of the green, and the green was over to the right. Perry Maxwell actually came in later and put the green up on the hill beyond that bunker and made it into a much longer par 4, and it's a great hole. So what he did there, I think, was great. But at the 17th, I'm dubious as to, you know, what he did there and whether it was an improvement. But
there was indeed a historic moment on that hole, besides the fact that Dwight Eisenhower used to hit that tree all the time. And that was in 1986 when Jack Nicklaus made that birdie putt to surge into the lead at the Masters and ultimately win.
I think that's I watched that on YouTube. I'm a bit sad. I'm a sad old golfer, and I just get a thrill watching that every time. And when he makes that putt and his reaction to it, and what he said afterwards about how the putt broke, and, you know, what he knew and all his experience about how that green worked and how the contours affected putts was just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. My two favorite quotes from that broadcast and the story of that tournament were on 16, actually, if you back up for a half a second, okay, Jack is standing over that short birdie putt when behind him, Tommy Nakajima and Tom Watson are playing number 15. And Ben Wright makes the following call. Nakajima is just stepping back and looking behind them because he knows Nicklaus is about to putt and he's going to get it blast into the ears in a moment. And sure enough, when that roar went up from the crowd, and just an enormous, okay, you'd have thought that the Super Bowl had just ended. And then on 17, Jack saying to Jackie, you know, Jackie's like, well, okay, Dad, does it break this far? He goes, no. Ray's Creek's going to hold it up just a little bit. Okay, that local knowledge of all those former Masters that he'd won and participated in. And sure enough, that thing never had a doubt. And seeing him raise that putter in the air, one of the great moments in the history of the game. But my goodness, okay, to win a green jacket and the atrocity that he wore, okay, a chiffon yellow shirt and picnic tablecloth trousers.
I just looked at a picture of that just a moment ago, and I thought, my goodness, what was he thinking when he woke up? That's quite the comment. But I watched that, you know, like I said, you know, on cold winter's nights when there's and the kids are out and my wife's out, you know, I am a bit sad, and I do go back to YouTube and I watch a few holes from the 1986 Masters, and I hear about that the Nakajima Watson, you know, waiting for Nicklaus to hold that par on 16, and I just think of you know, you look back in sports history, being English, you know, my sports history, if I was at the 1966 World Cup final, you know, and some of the great Super Bowls, obviously, for, you know, American sports fans, you know, if you were just there at the moment, I mean, just a thrill to be there. And I think if anyone listening was present and attended the 1986 Masters and saw some of this happen, you're just among the luckiest people alive, aren't you?
Well, I'll tell you, okay, it was the day, that Sunday was the day of our spring concert at Trinity College, and they were playing right outside my door. It was Psychedelic Furs, and I went out for one song, Don't You Forget About Me. I stayed in the rest of the time to watch Jack win the Masters. Everyone was like, what are you doing? I'm like, Jack's winning the Masters! He's shooting 65 on Sunday! Get your rear ends in here, you know, and finally, you know, people started to filter in when word got around, you know, and we watched it. I wasn't there, but I watched it as it happened, and it really was a magical moment, you know. It was like watching my beloved Steelers win the Super Bowl, or watching, you know, the Red Sox finally win the World Series. One of the greatest moments in sports history, Jack's final major win, you know, we all had written him off at 46, so.
Well, I remember I was on a geography field trip. I was at my middle school, I think, and I was 15, and we were on a field trip in Yorkshire, and it was late at night, you know, because obviously the Masters, you know, in British time, it was probably 11 or midnight, and we had a tiny little black and white portable TV in our room, in our dorm room. And I was a bit naughty. I turned it on because I knew the Masters was on. And we're getting pretty fuzzy, rubbish coverage, but you can just about make it out. And I'm looking at the leaderboard and thinking, wow, where's Jack Nicklaus come from? This is amazing. And I woke everyone else up in the room and said, guys, you got to watch this. I know this probably doesn't interest you, but you've got to watch this, because this is, even then I realized that this was a very big deal. Because Nicklaus was on
And I got one other good story for you about this time, too. But anyway, so then what happened?
So everyone was, you know, obviously reluctant to get up, and they were saying, shut up, Tony, just go to bed. And I said, no, seriously, you've got to watch this. So we all sat on the end of one bed and watched it, and it was when the Masters. And I'm not sure I made any golfers out of anyone that night, but they all did admit that it was pretty exciting.
I remember the night before it happened, okay, I was also a sports writer for the school newspaper, and we were all finishing up the evening's worth of work in the editorial room. As we were walking out, one of the other sports writers and the editor-in-chief were both there, and we had the leaderboard up, and we were looking at it. And one of them looks at me and says, what do you think the winning score is going to be? And remember that when they went to bed that night, 8-under was leading. And I took a look at this, and I said, well, look, there's a lot of pressure coming in tomorrow. You know, there's only one guy at 8, and I think he's going to have a tough time. I'm going to go with 9-under. And the kid next to me shook his head. He goes, nope, not low enough. He goes, I'm going to go with 11-under. And I said, well, I like that 9. I said, you know, it's kind of funny. You know, Nicklaus shoots 65, he'd get to 9-under. And we all kind of laughed at it.
Yeah.
Well, then Monday, when I walked on in Monday morning into the paper, that same kid stood up in front of everybody. And he goes, Jay called it. He called it 9-under. and there was this moment of silence. He looks at me. He goes, you know, because you really do make a great sports writer. I was like, you know, and you know, years later, because, you know, you go off and you become a lawyer, and you go off, you know, and you don't expect any of these things to happen, but they resonate back with you. Now, let's jump back a little bit. Some of the other holes that you chose, some excellent, excellent, excellent choices. You know, you've got the first hole at Cherry Hills when that triggered that 65 by Arnold Palmer to win the U.S. Open in 1960. You got holes from Prestwick. You got holes from St. George's, including one of my favorites, number 5, with the famous Big Bertha bunker, and on and on and on. So, you know, of course, everyone's going to have 2 or 3 on the list that they're going to disagree with. I'm going to throw you out one. I do have to say, okay, now this isn't just one disagreeing with you. This one's a gargantuan mistake. Okay, now, I mean this in fun and that gives you, but the 10th hole at Atlantic City, I mean, really, 10? You chose 10 in Atlantic City? Why not 16 or 17 or even 4, one of the waterside holes? Okay, you tell me why you picked 10, and then sadly I'm going to have to drop the hammer and tell you what's really going on with that hole. But go ahead.
Okay, here's my experience of Atlantic City. A couple of years ago, yeah, I was invited to the International Network of Golf Spring Conference in Atlantic City, which is, diplomatically, it wasn't one of my favorite places on earth.
You don't have to be diplomatic about it. It's the second happiest city on the eastern seaboard.
For some people, it's home, and I'm sure they love it, but I can't imagine anyone that would actually choose to move there. Anyway, this trip to Atlantic City came the opportunity to visit Atlantic City Country Club. So we went, and I was kind of, I knew a little bit about the history of the club before I went. And then when we got there, you know, everyone went to do their various things, but I actually wanted to stay behind and rummage through the clubhouse. And have you ever been in the clubhouse? You know, have the way the floor slides? That's incredible.
I've studied in that library. I love that library. Sometimes I'll just drive down there and hang out. Absolutely.
Well, the group didn't actually play the course 1-18. We were on the range with some folk there doing some reviewing some equipment, some products. But I wanted to rummage through the clubhouse, and I wanted to go out and walk the course. So I went out by myself and I walked the course, had a look around. And yeah, the holes down in the waterfront were very special and fantastic. But as I said before, this book wasn't about the best holes in the world. It's not about the best holes in history, and it certainly wasn't about the best holes at Atlantic City. I think if it had been the best holes, I'm not sure, to be honest, and with all due respect, I'm not sure Atlantic City would have made it into the book, because they're wonderful holes, but, you know, they're the best holes on that course, but I'm not sure they'd be among my favorite holes in the world.
It does have a major championship pedigree, and it does have a stately pedigree. And Tom Doak did a phenomenal job of restoring portions of the golf course and rebuilding portions of the golf course. However, Tom will tell you, in fact did tell me in an interview I did with him, that the 10th hole at Atlantic City is the greatest architectural mistake he ever made, and he wishes that he could have it back. The reason is a simple one. That hole is a dogleg right, and on the inside of the dogleg, the ninth hole comes back up. So everybody just blasts their drive into the ninth fairway and turns a 3-shot par 5 into a short par 4, just like they did at Inverness on number 8. Remember the famous Hinkle Tree incident when Non Hinkle got up there and said, "Hey, if I hit my tee shot into 17, it's a driver and an 8 iron on a par 5," and everybody followed them. Well, that's the same problem that we have with number 10. Okay, now, I'm going to make an analogy.
That bump music means we're going to have to take a short break. Don't go away. We'll be back at the second half of the show in just a minute. This is your main man, DJ Q, and you're listening to Jay's Place on the Golf News Net Radio Network.